From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, a virtual visit to Sudan. Our guests, Paula Hershoff and Chuck Ludlam, former Peace Corps volunteers and inveterate adventure travelers who just returned from a three-week trip to Sudan less than 1 year after the revolution of April 2019. To commemorate the anniversary of the Sudanese revolution, a popular revolt which threw off the autocratic yoke of former President Omar al-Bashir, we'll be talking with Paula and Chuck, who are, full disclosure, longtime personal friends, to glean a deeper understanding of the ancient Nubian culture and explore the links between the 4,000-year history of Nubian civilization and contemporary Sudan. Paula Hershoff is a writer, editor, and anthropologist. During her professional career, she wrote and reported on social, political, and economic issues for a wide variety of publications, often focusing on Africa. Since 1989, she has served as a docent at the Smithsonian Institute's National Museum of African Art. Chuck Ludlam is a public policy advocate, a lawyer. He served as counsel to U.S. congressional committees for 20 years, as counsel in the White House for 2 years, and as principal lobbyist for the biotechnology industry for 8 years. Today, he teaches university classes and mentors students to prepare them for public policy careers. Before we talk to Paula and Chuck, let's do a quick synopsis of Sudan's historic political transition that began in late 2018. In December of that year, demonstrations broke out in many Sudanese cities due to the rising cost of living and deteriorating economic conditions across society. The protests rapidly turned from demands for urgent economic reforms into calls for President Omar al-Bashir to step down after the government's violent crackdown on the protests sparked international concern in February 2019. Omar al-Bashir declared a state of emergency. However, 1 year ago this month, April 2019, the military removed al-Bashir from power in a coup d'etat and installed the Transitional Military Council, or TMC. After intermittent bouts of violence, in July last year, the military generals and civilian opposition leaders reached a power-sharing deal mediated by the African Union. The deal established a governing body called the Sovereignty Council to rule Sudan for a three-year transitional period until elections can be held. Abdullah Hamdok was appointed prime minister. Now let's turn to Chuck and Paula, who join us via Skype from their home in Washington, D.C. Paula, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. I'm pleased to be here.
And Chuck, salam alaikum to you too.
Walaikum salam.
Okay. I'm going to first start with you, Paula. And before we get into your incredible itinerary, let me ask you both, first to you, Paula, what prompted you to make this trip at this historic moment in Sudanese history? And I know you've had an interest in Sudan since the inception of your career. So I'd like you to talk about that and your impressions of the people of Sudan.
Well, I'd studied ancient Nubia when I was doing graduate work in anthropology. And I wrote several papers about Kerma and Merowe and the ancient Nubian civilization. And also at the museum in the 1990s, we had an exhibition coming from the Boston Museum of Fine Arts called Ancient Nubia, Egypt's Rival in Africa. And so I was giving tours of that at the same time. And I just developed a really powerful interest in ancient Nubia. Then the revolution came last year, and it seemed like the right time to go. It seemed like a very exciting transition for Sudan and a rare example of a moving to democracy from a dictatorship. So that's when we decided to go.
And before I turn to Chuck, what were your impressions of the people of Sudan? What struck you?
They were so warm and welcoming. We couldn't believe it. They seemed honored that we had come there and that we were Americans visiting. And they would invite us into their homes for tea and talk. And they were always very interested in what was happening, whether we were going to lift the sanctions or not, and whether Americans were going to start coming to Sudan. And they were really very respectful of us. They weren't at all aggressive. They didn't do any begging. They weren't trying to get us to buy anything. They just wanted to be hospitable and find out more why we were there. And it turns out they're very proud of their ancient history and they're proud of the revolution. And we heard that again and again, and we saw it, you know, everywhere we looked, we could see signs of this pride and this trying to link the two, the ancient history and the current contemporary affairs.
We'll explore more of that as we continue our conversation. But let me now turn to Chuck. You're a major world traveler, Chuck. I can't keep up with you. What was the impetus for you, and what were your first impressions of the people and the country at this incredible historic juncture?
Thank you. We love Africa most of all. I mean, I've traveled in 85 countries. Paul has probably traveled in 65 countries. So we have seen a lot. Sudan's been on my list of places to go for many years. I was thinking that I would do a camel trip somewhere in Sudan, but I'm a little older now. So we ended up doing 18 days on the road. But I'm fascinated with Muslim countries. We lived in Senegal for 2 years. As Peace Corps volunteers, I've traveled in 6 or 8 North African Muslim countries. So we're especially interested in Muslim countries. And I'm always interested in countries that have an interesting political story. And the political story in Sudan is just as fascinating, if not more fascinating, than the one we saw a while back in Burma and Myanmar. So it's a fabulous place. And I had the same impression as Paul of the people. Are kind, they're gentle, they're not aggressive, they're Sufi Muslim, they were welcoming, the guest is God, and they treated us that way, constantly inviting us in for tea or into their homes. So it was just a very heartwarming story and experience, but even more is that this is a country that hosted a 4,000-year civilization in Nubia, so they're unbelievable places to visit. We had unbelievable guides through a company called Real Sudan. And it was a fabulous trip, wonderful trip.
Well, we're going to get into those details and the link between the long history and contemporary Sudan. So back to you, Paula. Talk more about your itinerary, where you went, what were some of the highlights of the 4,000-year history of Nubian civilization that you learned about and some of the sites that you visited.
I would say two of the highlights were ancient Kerma and ancient Meroe. And Kerma dates back 4,000 years, and it had an incredible civilization at that time. There was a kingdom, an advanced urban society. And what we saw there were the huge structures they had built that were still standing in part, of course, severely eroded. But they were religious centers, and they were called the Defufa, the Eastern and Western Defufa. So that was a definite highlight. And then in Meroe, which was, as time went by, as the centuries went by, the Nubian capitals moved south on the Nile, and probably partly to put more distance between them and Egypt, their rival. And there were all the pyramids, and they were definitely a highlight. I think the most exciting thing was the first three pyramids that we saw, and the biggest one of all, were for queens. And I didn't know beforehand, but these queens ruled ancient Nubia, and there were at least 9 or 10 of them on their own, and then others who ruled with their husbands. And they're depicted in very vivid, colorful detail on the walls of the pyramids. And you can still see them. You can still see the yellows and browns of the natural dyes. And these were African queens. They had African features. They were very strong, and they were holding a spear in one hand and to smite the enemies. And, you know, they had muscles, and they had powerful bodies. And I would say they just looked like they were powerful rulers. So that was quite a highlight. But there were many, many other highlights. Climbing up on Jebel Barkal was a highlight. And it was during the Napata period when Jebel Barkal was the capital and the religious center where all the pharaohs came to be crowned. So we climbed up on top for sunset, which was wonderful. And it's surrounded by pyramids and temples. There are more pyramids in Sudan than there are in Egypt. You know, Egypt, we hear more about, and Sudan, for many reasons, has been not studied as much or in school, and people don't travel there as much.
Exactly. Well, actually, I want to pick up on that and turn now to Chuck, the historian between you, although you are too, Paula. Chuck, I'd like to get your take on some of the highlights, but also this rivalry between Egypt and Sudan. And why is it that we somehow know more about Egypt as opposed to Sudan and the Nubian culture, which in many ways may rival or surpass that of ancient Egypt? Talk about that.
Well, actually, the Nubian civilization was twice as long as the Egyptian civilization. It's possible that pyramids were invented in Nubia. It's possible that monarchy was invented in Nubia. I mean, we're talking 4,000 years. This is an unbelievable story, going from Kerma to Jebel Barkal to Meroweh to Old Dongola. They have an 800-year Christian history in Sudan at the end. They were rivals with Egypt. Egypt did conquer Nubia at times, but they had so much respect for the Nubians that they didn't treat them as slaves. They incorporated them in their armies. The Nubian warriors were incredibly famous, and they had wonderful arts, pottery, and iron making. And then at one point, Nubia turned tables and conquered all of Egypt. Nubia controlled all of Egypt, all the way from Khartoum into Lebanon.
Wow.
25th dynasty for 100 years. And then when they were finally kicked out of Egypt, they were kicked out by the Assyrians, not the Egyptians. They beat the Persians. They beat the Greeks. I mean, we're talking about Greeks. They beat Alexander the Great. He did not invade Nubia. They beat the Romans. This is Augustus Caesar, did not invade Nubia. Then they had a pact with the Islamic groups that lasted 600 years, the longest peace treaty in the history of the world, maintained Christianity in Sudan for 800 years. Eventually, they became Muslim, but only in the 14th and 15th centuries. So it's just an unbelievable story. And I guess the question is, how is it possible that one group of people, more or less, could be so adaptable and so well-led and be such innovators and such smart traders and such great warriors that they could maintain a civilization for 4,000 years? It's just an unbelievable story, and you can see evidence of this everywhere you go. Now, Egypt is very dramatic, of course. The pyramids are the ones they have are completely immense. And you go to Karnak and places like that, and the Valley of the Kings, the Valley of the Queens. I mean, they have cemetery and mortuary areas in Sudan that are unbelievable also. But Egypt is more accessible. I mean, Sudan has not been a favorite place to travel for 30 years when Bashir was in power.
True.
Then they've had terrible, unfortunate associations with terrorists and others. So I think at some point Sudan will become on a par with Egypt, or at least everybody who goes to Egypt ought to go to Sudan. And there are like 10 million people every year go to Egypt, and only about a million that go to Sudan. My guess is those numbers will equal out as people find out how incredible Sudan is.
Well, we'll get into that more after the break. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Joining me via Skype are Paula Hershoff and Chuck Ludlam, from whom you just heard. Paula Hershoff is a writer, editor, and anthropologist with extensive experience in Africa. Her husband, Chuck Ludlam, is a lawyer, public policy advocate, and adjunct professor. And we're talking about their recent 3-week trip to Sudan as we commemorate the anniversary of the revolution of April 2019. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast continues to be available for download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener whom I haven't heard from in a long while, Ray Ondoro from Nairobi, Kenya. Ray, I miss your emails full of astute political observations. Please let us know how you're doing and how you and your family are navigating this coronavirus pandemic. We wish you and all our friends in Africa good health and well-being. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our special guests, Paula Hirschhoff and Chuck Ludlam. Paula, as you both alluded to, there are parallels, linkages between the ancient and the contemporary. What links did you see between Nubia's ancient glory and strength and today's Sudan?
I just talked about the queens who ruled during the Meroitic period. But today in the revolution, women took leading roles and were at the forefront of the protests that happened last year. So I think it's important to emphasize the role of women. And apparently the Sudanese people feel that it's important as well, because in every village and every city that we visited, every town, we saw murals and paintings on the school walls. Every school compound has a wall around it. And those walls are painted as a means to educate the school kids. And on the walls, they would paint the ancient queens. And even the king, we saw reference to the Black Pharaoh Taharqa, who was the most famous one. And then they would have captions were in Arabic, but our guide would translate them for us. And there seemed to be a theme in a lot of the paintings were references to the revolution. But the ones about the ancient history would refer to rebuilding the country. We can be great again. We can out of the depths that we've been in for 30 years under the dictatorship. I think these were painted during the revolution and then maybe some of them later. So that was really wonderful and impressive. And then you'd see right alongside, you'd see a woman who was clearly in a protest running. So contemporary and ancient women depicted together.
So I just add that one of the pictures you, Paul, has referred to is the military was lobbing tear gas canisters at the protesters. And there's a famous photograph of a young girl grabbing the canister and throwing it back at the military. And you can see this on these murals on the walls on the schools. It's very dramatic.
And very moving. And then they are proud. They are very proud of their ancient history. And I think the archaeologists who are working there today are trying to build on that pride by having monthly sort of teach-ins. They invite the surrounding villagers to come to the site and update them on the latest discoveries there. And they listen to them when they, you know, use some contemporary wisdom to talk about the ancient finds. And then the guards, the government guards who protect all the ancient sites. And those guards are curious about what they're protecting. So the archaeologists are trying to teach them as well. So it was heartening to see those efforts. And so that would be another way that the past is reaching out to the present and linking it.
And Chuck, do you have anything more to add to the linkages between Nubia's ancient glory and today's Sudan?
Well, the sites are very well maintained and respected. They have guards, but I think they don't need them. I think there is a very deep respect for the sites. The sites are very dramatic. Right in the middle, I mean, the country is huddled around the Nile, so the sites are quite accessible, quite near to cities and everything else, but people have a great interest. We saw school groups in there. Seeing the story, there are something like 40 archaeological digs going on in Sudan in the current time. I mean, we visited 4 digs on our trip, which was a fantastic experience to meet with the archaeologists. And so I think that they need strength now. This transition to democracy will be difficult. There have been 30 years of very, very deep mistakes in Sudan. They lost South Sudan. They lost part of the country. They lost much of their oil to South Sudan when it became a country in 2011. There are deep wounds in Darfur. There are still problems in South Kordofan and the Blue Nile and places like that. You know, the military is still large and potentially threatening. They need strength now. They have 39 months to negotiate an election to bring civilians back in power. They do have civilians in a majority on the council at the moment, but they have refugees, some of them internally, some of them from South Sudan, some of them from other places. So it's going to be very complex unwinding the mistakes, and they need to go back to the time when they had so much to be proud of. This may have been the longest civilization in the history of the world.
Indeed. And then you also both, just about the time you left Sudan in mid-March, there was an assassination attempt on Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. So that doesn't bode well either, Chuck. How do you see that?
Yes, that happened the day after we left, and it was on a bridge that we had seen it. It was a pretty half-hearted attempt, it looked like. There had been a previous minor attempt at a coup by the military. Look, the military there is very dangerous, because they've had 30 years of favors from Bashir. They were running loose, creating mayhem and genocide in Darfur and South Sudan. So the military has been privileged and they've been pampered. They're powerful. But the country depends on restraint on the part of the military. Getting back to the point where they're no longer on the terrorist list of the U.S., which we certainly think makes sense given what we saw, and getting back a banking system and get relationships with the IMF and the World Bank. I mean, none of this will happen if the military clings to power and tries to reassert itself. So we need unbelievable restraint in order to fulfill the hopes that all of the people in Sudan have.
And we've heard that the military is divided. It's not like all of them want to take over again. They recognize that the last government was pretty incompetent, and so they're not eager to go back to that either. And the people, the civilian protesters, the opposition people, they are vigilant now. They are not going to let it happen again, at least not very easily. And they kept protesting. It was a long, long, many months went by, you know, when before they finally got their transitional government towards democracy. So I think that there is hope. And I think that we should all really respect that hope and do whatever we can to help them in this transition.
Absolutely. And you said that they were asking curiously about the relationship between the United States, wanting to know when Americans would visit, which is so heartwarming. If I understand it, Washington has vowed to remove Sudan from the state sponsor of terror list, correct, Chuck? But I'm not sure exactly where the implementation of that stands.
Well, it's a complicated process. It's not just a single decision. There are a whole series of decisions. But Sudan has been doing some incredible things to try. I mean, we are exchanging ambassadors for the first time in 23 years with Sudan. They have reached a settlement with the families of the coal victims. They're working on a settlement regarding the Kenyan and Tanzanian embassy bombings. They're working on finalizing agreements with Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile, and other places. I mean, they have a lot on their plate, but the government is showing great good faith at this point. And I think if we want to encourage that, we need to reward them for the amazing progress that they have made, just completely amazing. And the best single thing we could do, which would be very symbolic and very practical, would be to acknowledge that they are no longer state sponsors of terrorism.
Indeed. Well, we hope that that day will come very soon. But of course, they're not immune to the coronavirus pandemic. I believe there are some cases in Sudan that can't help the many challenges that they're already experiencing.
I think they only have 2 cases are of coronavirus in Sudan.
They house 1.8 million refugees. Isn't that right, Chuck, and IDPs?
Yes, yes. And some of them are coming in from other countries. They're not internal just to Sudan, but they've got neighbors who are living in troubled times around the periphery of Sudan. So that's part of it. But they need to unwind all of that. I mean, Bashir did unbelievable damage and for 30 years. So unwind will take a lot of work.
Paula, back to you about some of your observations about the art and the architecture and the archaeology. It must be also difficult for the country to maintain these incredible sites. They're competing with so many other necessities, just economic and day-to-day needs. How do they balance that? To what extent are they going to be able to continue to maintain these sites such that more and more people can visit them?
The sites, they're run by archaeologists from abroad, most of them. Well, I think they try to have Sudanese archaeologists, but there may not be that many of them trained yet. You know, they're in the process of engaging more and more Sudanese in this work. But for now, they have concessions, they call it. They give concessions to various universities around the world. And you can see so many different ones working there, Polish and German and American. So the government does provide guards for each site, but I think they're very low paid. So it's a huge constraint. But they're now, one thing we didn't mention, with they've already put into the curriculum that they're going to start studying ancient Nubia, which, you know, has not been part of the school curriculum previously.
Really?
Yeah, because they were more focused on, especially during colonial times, on the British history, I suppose. So that is going to be part of the education system from now on. So I don't know about the future of these sites, but they're longing for tourists to come visit them, and they are fascinating and very impressive. So we encourage people that it will help a lot. You know, they're planning for an influx of tourists by building more places for them to stay, more accommodation to make it easier for larger groups to come.
I wonder if U.S. companies or hotel chains might be interested in investing there, Chuck.
Well, I think that this goes back to the terrorism listing, because U.S. banks or international banks have a hard time dealing with Sudan when they're still on that list. The IMF and the World Bank are restrained. So I think that is one of the key things that we'll have to do to get back to it. But their facilities there are pretty good for tourists already. There are some of the sites, there are even first-class hotels. There are guest houses pretty much everywhere, which we found to be quite reasonable. They've also got many, many things that to see aside from the ancient wonders. They have wonderful markets. They have amazing camel markets. I mean, just unbelievable camel markets. They have one camel market where they only sell racing camels. It's fantastic. We went to see a gold mining. There's gold mining place. You can go right into the gold mining fields. Brick making, pottery making, blacksmithing. I mean, there is a lot to see there that deals with Sudan as it exists now. And then you take all of these unbelievable sites from the ancient times. I mean, it's a wonderful place to visit.
And Paula, doesn't the word Nubia mean gold?
They think that is the source of the word, yes.
Well, it's just an amazing journey that you did, and extraordinary for so many reasons. And what a privilege for you both to be there at this most important political...
It really was. It was a fabulous trip.
Well, do you have, Paula, first to you, any final thoughts that you want to share that we didn't touch upon during our conversation?
Well, as we talked, I did think about how much assimilation and intermarriage there had been between Nubians and Egyptians. You know, we talk about it as a completely separate thing, but we should realize there is a lot of overlap as well between Egypt and Nubia. And so that was one point I wanted to make or clarify.
That's true. I guess one third of Egypt is considered part of Nubia.
Yes.
And two thirds
yes.
of Sudan.
It's like an 800-mile stretch along the Nile that was where the Nubian civilization flourished. So a third of that is in southern Egypt and two thirds is in northern Sudan.
So that would exclude today's independent state of South Sudan. Or does it include part
yes.
of that territory?
No.
Okay, fabulous. And Chuck, any last final thoughts from you?
Well, the Sudanese really captured our hearts. I mean, we have been all over the world. They captured our hearts and our respect, because they've gone through a very long nightmare. They were incredibly courageous in fighting to get rid of Bashir. Hundreds were killed. And now they are in a very structured, organized transition to democracy, and we just wish them the best. They absolutely deserve it.
Paula Hershoff and Chuck Ludlam are former Peace Corps volunteers. They're distinguished professionals and policy advocates and lovers of Africa, especially, of course, Sudan. Thanks, Paula and Chuck, for sharing your amazing insights and observations about your recent adventure in Sudan.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is